So today we are going to continue the discussion we just started at the end of last lecture, namely quantization of a quantum field theory, a simple one, a free field, scalar free field, using path integral methods or functional integrals methods. And I'm going to show that one can recover quite easily and have a new view on what you did in the QFT1 course. So, free field quantization continued. Okay, so I remind you that the free field is just, we have a field phi of x, which is a real field, a classical theory. X as Tx is a four-vector in Minkowski space, namely 1d minus 1 Minkowski space. The action, the classical action S of phi is integral d of x over Minkowski space of, with my notation, minus 1 half of d mu phi, d mu phi, minus m squared over 2 phi squared. Remember that I choose for metric signature minus, plus, plus, plus. Okay? And we have seen that in principle we should be able to construct a functional integral of the form integral over all field configuration in space-time times exponential of I over h bar times the classical action. And we have seen that in order to make sense of this, we take the continuum limit. In fact, we have to do something similar to what we did in path integral quantization for a single particle, namely discretized time and space by replacing space-time by a lattice. Well, that's one of the ways to define the model. There are others. So namely here we have time, we have x, and we have some epsilon mesh. This is a mesh of the lattice. Z to the power of u is mesh equal epsilon. Okay? By the way, in fact, quantum field theory defined on lattice, in fact, started to be heavily used in the 70s. With the advent of lattice gauge theory. But the idea of discretizing space-time is much older, and I think it goes back to Heisenberg in the 30s or the beginning of the 40s. So it's an old idea, in fact. Okay. And we have seen that if we discretize space-time, what we do is that we replace d phi means, in fact, to each site of the lattice, in fact, is labeled by some vector I belonging to the ZD, and there is a point XI, which is simply epsilon times I in space-time, in a Minkowski space, and to each site lattice leaves a field variable phi I, which is phi of XI, and so this functional integral is replaced by a, well, still infinite dimensional, but discrete infinite dimensional, namely d phi means basically products on all the sides on my lattice of d phi of I with a normalization, which is 2i pi h bar divided by epsilon to the power d minus 2 with a factor 1 half. Something like that. 1 half or minus 1 half? I have to check. I think it's minus 1 half. Yes, minus 1 half. Okay. And the discrete version is just action is the action is replaced by some discretized action obtained by replacing the integral by a sum over the site of the lattice and the derivative by finite difference operator. So you replace integral over dd of x by sum over the sites of the lattice epsilon times d, the volume element of the lattice, and you replace d mu by finite differences operators. Okay. So, well, that's for quantum field theory in Minkowski space. And you may ask, can we do the same thing for Euclidean space-time? We are going to use that later on. So, but the recipe is always the same. We have seen that going to Euclidean space-time means that instead of considering a vector that is tx, we consider that t is minus I times some imaginary variable. So in fact, now we have an Euclidean vector xe, which is basically what tau x in our old notation, but you can just say that this is x0, x1 up to x d minus 1. So it's a vector in Euclidean spacetime Rd. Okay, you can discretize Euclidean spacetime using a lattice discretization exactly in the same way. And now the path integrals becomes, the Euclidean path integrals becomes integral over dE of phi of exponential of minus 1 over h bar, some Euclidean action for a field configuration defined in this Euclidean spacetime. And the rules are the same, namely now the Euclidean measure is just the product over the sites of my lattice of d phi I, but again, the I factor will disappear, so I get a 2 pi h bar divided by epsilon d minus 2 to the power minus 1 half. And most importantly, the Euclidean action becomes, well, remember, to go from the ordinary action to the Euclidean action, you have to keep with the same sign the term that involves time derivative and reverse the kinetic part and change the signs of the term that is the potential energy that doesn't involve time derivative. Okay, so here the time derivative is minus d0 phi d0 phi, but the Minkowski signature is minus for this time. So Euclidean space-time, of course, has a signature plus with my notation. So the first term is plus 1 half dt phi squared. So this doesn't change. But the other sense, which is minus 1 half the special derivative of phi squared, gets a plus sign. So what we get is that simply integral dx, and let me specify that I am walking Euclidean space. So I get a factor plus 1 half d mu phi d mu phi, where this is just an ordinary scalar product, plus m squared over 2 phi squared. Okay. So this is the Euclidean action. And this is the Euclidean functional integral. Okay. So Well, up to now, this is just, I've defined a model, I defined a big integral, but I've not done anything with it. So you may object, can we do something with that? Can we compute things? And that's where path integral quantization come out to be very convenient. So we are going to compute the analog of what you did in the tutorials yesterday and what we defined but didn't compute in quantum mechanics later on. Yes? I don't care here because, okay, if you want really to be sure, I don't care because here, since the signature is plus plus, the metric tensor Euclidean is just 1, 1, 1. So getting upper and lower indices are the same. Okay. But you are right. Here it's different for the first term. And here there is no difference. Okay, so we are going to discuss what we call the correlation functions. Namely, the matrix element between some quantum states of field operator. And, well, again, by these rules of path integral, if it works, so if the quantization by functional integrals makes sense, there should be a correspondence principle between the operators in the canonical quantization and this random variable in the path integral. So there should be a correspondence between the field operator phi at a given point in space-time. This is an operator, the operator that you have been constructing in the QFT1 course using creation and annihilation operator of modes of the field, so creation and annihilation of particles with mass m acting in the Fock space of the which is the Hilbert space of the system, and this field variables, phi of x, this function of x, we integrate over. So if everything works, we should be able to compute a correlation function or expectation value of operator. So let me start by the calculation of the two-point function. And I'm going to compute the two-point function in Euclidean space simply because in the Euclidean theory. And we are going to go to the real-time physical theory a bit later, simply here because it's a bit simpler. Okay, so I'm going to remember, I want to compute, I take two variables phi of x at 2 points x1 and x2 in my Euclidean space-time. So I have my Euclidean space-time, I have 2 points x1 and x2. I am taking, considering infinite dimensional space-time, so both x0 here and all the x's are infinite. So this is Rd. Okay. And I want to compute with my path integral this correlation function that is called the two-point function, because I'm considering the expectation value of two fields operator at 2 points. So by definition of the path integral, this is just the integral of a d phi, well, with the Euclidean signature of exponential minus 1 over h bar se of phi. And then I add in my path integral the value of the field at point x1 and the value of the field at point x2. And I normalized Remember, we have to normalize by the path integral. In order to get normalized amplitude or normalized probability, we want to have that the expectation value of the identity operator is one, always. Okay. So that's the rule coming from path integral quantization. That's the object we define. So how can we compute this? Well, it turns out that it's very easy to compute this object because this is a Gaussian integral. And that's because the Euclidean as well as the real-time action is in fact some integral that involves only products of things acting over the two fields. So it's a quadratic form in phi. SE is a S of phi, and SE of phi is a quadratic form. And well, imagine that I am in infinite space, but I take periodic boundary condition. In some sense, I can rewrite this as SE of I equal integral dd of x. And here I can make a partial integration to rewrite this as 1/2 phi of x minus the Laplace operator that I'm going to write, Laplace operator acting on phi of x. And I'm going to write this like that, minus squared plus m squared phi of x. Where this is a d-dimensional Laplace operator. So delta of x acting on phi of x is simply d mu, d mu of phi of x. Okay, the standard. And if you are a bit annoyed by why is it justified to go from this to this? Imagine that RD is replaced by a d-dimensional torus with periodic boundary condition, and we take the limit of the torus to be infinite at the end. Remember, we are already used to have one of the dimensions, namely Euclidean time, to be periodic, but you can also consider space to be periodic, and then consider define infinite dimensional space as the limit of an infinitely large torus. And then it's fine. You can be more careful, and then you will have some boundary condition terms, but they will not be important. The important point is that SE is a quadratic form. And you know that for a general quadratic form, this is the integral of the exponential of a quadratic form on phi. And you have seen in the math lectures in the previous year or in the reminder this year that the integral of a Gaussian gives the determinant, something proportional to the determinant. So we know, I'm going to discuss that a little bit more carefully, we know that the partition function, let us say dE of phi exponential minus 1 over h bar s of phi, this will be, roughly speaking, proportional to the determinant of this operator. To the power minus 1/2. Is it clear? Of course, this is a determinant of an operator acting. This is an operator which acts on a function space, which is an infinite dimensional space. So one has to be careful. And in fact, this determinant, as I wrote it, is not perfectly well defined. There are infinities because it's an operator that has an infinite number of eigenvalues. These eigenvalues are maybe arbitrarily large. So the product of the eigenvalues is something that is not very well defined. So let's call this determinant with a quotes. But there is a way to make sense of that. We are going to discuss that probably a bit later. But at the moment, imagine that if you go back to the fact that space-time is discretized, and in addition, it is a finite size, then this integral over phi becomes an integral over a finite number of variables. So this operator becomes an operator acting on finite dimensional vectors. So it's a matrix, and the determinant of the matrix is perfectly well defined. So one has to make sense of this as defined as the limit when epsilon goes to zero and the size L of space-time goes to infinity. Okay. But since I won't need really that at that moment, let us assume that we can just make sense of the determinant. Now here we are not computing the determinant. We are computing what's called the cumulant, the two-point cumulant of the exponential of this Gaussian form. And we know that in general, for a quadratic form, if I have an integral over a product of, let us say, products from I A equal 1 to capital N of d phi A of exponential minus 1 half phi A some matrix d A B phi B with a convention of repeated indices written. Okay, and I this Gaussian integral. So I have a Gaussian form A, well, I'm sorry, DAB that is symmetric and positive. Then we know that with this weight, if I am computing the average of phi A and phi B, this is simply, here I have a sum over A and B. I'm just saying 2 phi B. It's known that this is simply the matrix element AB of the inverse matrix, of the inverse of the matrix D. So D minus 1 is the inverse of the matrix D. Okay? So, this object here should correspond. So let me call this G. Let me give a name to that. This function, g naught of x1 and x2, which is the expectation value of phi of x1 times phi of x2, computed with this functional integral we see, should be simply the matrix element of the inverse of the operator minus Laplacian plus m squared taken between the point x1 and x2 for the point x1, x2. Okay. So we can note this in a very sketchy form as 1 over minus Laplacian plus m squared between the point x1, well, that's capital X1, and the point capital X2. Okay, so that's just a notation. Let me go a little bit up. A notation to state that this is the matrix element of this inverse. Okay. Or, if you prefer, if you want to use Remember, since this is an operator, you can consider inverse of this operator and use bra and ket's notation. That's exactly the same things. X2, x1. I can use the operational notation where this is called the kernel of the operator minus Laplacian plus m squared minus 1. And you can use also the Bray and Ket notation of ordinary quantum mechanics. That's just two different ways to write the same object. Okay, and then, of course, for the moment, I've just discussed a little written. Oops. Yes, of course, you want to compute this object. Here I am. And what does this mean? To mean that it's the inverse. Well, the inverse. If I have a matrix D whose matrix elements are DAB, this AB goes from 1 to some n. The matrix element D minus 1 AB is defined by the fact that D times D minus 1 is equal to 1, namely D, I prefer, let me write like that. This is, we have DAB. D minus 1 BC summed over B must be equal to delta AB, AC. This is just writing in terms of component the fact that D minus 1 is equal to 1. Okay. So we have the same thing for it. And this means here that this function G naught of x1 and x2 is such that minus the operator minus the Laplacian plus m squared, but the operator, the Laplacian with respect to the variable x1 applied to g of x1 and x2. So this is a function of x1 and x2, has to be the matrix element of the identity operator. So the matrix element of the identity operator is just the delta distribution or the delta function in D dimension at coinciding points. Okay? Is this clear? That's simply because if I apply, remember, this is an operator that acts on function. So if I have an operator A acting on functions, let us call them f of x, this operator can be represented by its kernel. Well, not all operators can be represented by kernels, but a large class of them can be represented by kernel. And the action of A on the function f is a function AF of x given by integral over dy of a of x and y, f of y. You see, so f is a function, AF is another function, its value applied to x is replaced by the, is equal to the convolution of f by the kernel a of x and f. And you see that for a to be the identity operator, the kernel has to be a delta function. Okay, so this means that in fact, g of this function, g naught, well, I don't really need to write a g naught because it's simply because to remember that we are considering the free field. So let us call it g naught because it's a free field. Then, g naught has to satisfy this function. And rather, in fact, I forgot an important point. There is an h-bar on the denominator. So Oh, yes. So in fact, this has to be equal to h bar and this object. Okay. Or if you prefer, well, I have to check what are my notation. Yeah, no, my notation will be that g naught, that this function, phi of x, phi of y, will be equal to h bar times this object, where this object, I call it g naught. Okay. Okay. Okay, so this is the solution. And you see, you get this, that g naught is a solution of this equation simply back from the fact that the functional integral of a phi is a Gaussian integral. Okay. So now what is the solution of this function? What is the solution? Solution. Well, the best way to find the solution is simply to go to Fourier transform. So first, we can check very easily that this function g naught of x1 minus x of x1 and x2, and in fact, and is in fact a function of x1 minus x2, and that's basically because of translation invariance. Namely, it comes from the fact that this operator commutes with the generator of translation. Namely, lambda plus m squared commute with d mu. Okay. Now, we can go to Fourier transform. We can write the Fourier transform of this equation by defining g hat naught of k. Well, let me have it a capital K, because k is a d-dimensional vector. Right, the usual definition, this is dd of x of exponential minus I x vector k times g naught of x. That's the definition of the Fourier transform. And this equation becomes, well, the Fourier transform of minus the Laplacian, since minus the Laplacian is minus two derivatives with respect to mu. The Fourier transform of this object is just a diagonal in Fourier space, it's k squared. So the equation becomes k squared plus m squared times g hat naught of k equals the Fourier transform of the Dirac peak, which is just one from this very definition. Okay? So this two-point function is just g naught hat of k equal 1 over k squared plus m squared. So it's a Lorentzian function. And we go back by inverse Fourier transform to g naught of x. This is integral d dk over 2 pi to the power d. This is the definition, normalization. Exponential I x times k. This is a vector product of x and k times 1 over k squared plus m squared. Okay? And, well, again, since I'm going in Fourier transform, remember that x is a vector x0 up to xd minus 1. So k is a vector k0 up to kd minus 1. And xk means x mu k mu with the summation of other indices. Okay. And k squared, of course, is sum over mu of k mu squared, because again, my signature of space-time is plus, plus, plus. Okay. Okay. So we have computed by basically a Gaussian integration and inverting of an operator that is diagonalizable in Fourier space. We obtain immediately this two-point function without relying on operators, commutation relation, creation and annihilation operator, which is not very difficult either. And in fact, you get the same equation by this method. But you get that. Okay. So before going to discuss the properties of this equation, let me go back to real-time space. And perhaps this blackboard will be a bit small, so let me go. Okay. So in real time, it means that I want to go from, remember, I want to go from x naught is an Euclidean time. Okay. So to real time means that we want to make a Vic rotation where x naught is I times the real time, t. So that if x naught is the axis here, this is the axis of real time. Or if you are walking in the axis of Euclidean time, this is the axis for real times. Okay, it's just we make a Vic rotation with angle pi over 2. And what do we expect? Remember, we computed an expectation value of products of two field operator in an Euclidean setting with two x1 and x2, with x1 with x equals this x1 and x, something like that. By Vic rotation, if the rules that we have shown to be all true, to be true in quantum mechanics should still be continued, we should expect to get. This is a calculation done in infinite space and time. So Euclidean time is infinite, which means that I'm projecting out on the ground state, on the vacuum state of the field. So I'm projecting, I should get the vacuum or ground state expectation value. This is the vacuum state of the quantum field theory of the products of two field operators that depends both on space and time, because now Higgs is T Higgs. And then the ordering in time should account. So I should obtain the vacuum matrix element or the vacuum expectation value of the time ordered product of those two field operators, phi of x1, phi of x2. And I remind you that what you have seen, this is the time ordered product these two fields operator. Field operator. Operators. And I remind you that if I am writing my now Minkowski space-time diagram, if x1 is here, this is a light cone, and if x1 is here and x2 is here, this is phi of x2 times phi of x1, because x2 lies in the future of x1. If x2 is here, this is phi of x2 times phi of x1, because x2 lies in the past of x1. And if x1 is in the space region, the operator commutes, so the ordering is not important. Okay. So, can we check whether we recover something that you have computed in the QFT1 course from our simple calculation in Euclidean spacetime? What we have to do is just to start from this expression. G naught of x, which is integral. So let me rewrite this. So let me write x, this is x naught. So this is integral over x naught, an integral over my space variable x, because I'm going, so I'm in the Euclidean setting. So I write that x is x naught and x. Exponential, and then I'm writing I, and this is x naught. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm integrating over k naught and k, because my k vector is k naught and k. So this is I x naught k naught plus x times k, 1 over k naught squared plus k squared plus m squared. Okay? So this is the expression we have computed. And now we want to perform this weak rotation. I'm going to rewrite it. So I want to perform a weak rotation where I start from x naught and I go to real time. So I write that x naught equal I times time by making a weak rotation. So if I make a transformation like that, of course, this is not an exponential of the phase anymore, because you get exponential of minus t times k naught, which grows on one of the end of the integration line. But this is not important because we integrate over k naught. And we are free to make a deformation of the contour in k naught as long as the integral is still convergent, Cauchy principle. So let me write now the corresponding plane where this is k naught. Okay, and this is the imaginary axis for the Euclidean momenta, k naught. So going from this integration domain, well, going from this line to this point, oh, there is no integration in k naught, so I'm a bit. So going from this point, which is Euclidean point, to a point where with real time, I can do that if simultaneously I deform my integration contour here over the integral of k naught, so that this scalar product x naught times k naught is always real, so that this is still a phase. Well, I can do that, of course, if I rotate it in the opposite way and x. So if when I perform my Vick rotation, I rotate my contour of integration like that. Namely, I change k naught into 1 over I times some variable, and I'm going to call it omega, a frequency. Well, it's not a frequency, it's a pulsation, but a real-time frequency or energy. Okay. So omega is minus the imaginary part of k naught when I go to complex k naught. You see? Okay. Then, of course, this equation becomes, if I make, I consider that now x naught is imaginary like that, and if I make this change variable for k naught, what I get is that an integral over d omega, an integral over d minus 1 of k, I not touch the k, I get an exponential of I omega t plus kx. The I comes from the change variable in k naught and the fact that we integrate from plus infinity to minus infinity, because we have turned in this way. So there is a I factor here that comes from, the fact that we integrate dk naught should become 1 over I d omega, but integrating from minus infinity to plus infinity. So if I integrate from minus infinity to plus infinity, I get factor I. Well, there is always this factor, 2 pi and 2 pi d minus 1 that are important, unimportant, but let us keep them. And what I get is here is, there is a factor minus I. Okay, so let me write. This is a factor I here. Here I get the factor omega squared minus k squared minus m squared. I'm sorry, there is a factor minus I because of this. Okay, so I get this. Okay, so we should get this. But you have to be a bit careful because, remember, the numerator now is this, and this has a pole. There is a pole at omega equal plus or minus k squared plus m squared. Square root of k squared plus m squared, which is positive. There is a pole. Here, the pole is not in the real axis of the variables, but here the pole is somewhere on the real axis for the omegas. Well, why is it so? That's because here there was a pole at k naught equal plus or minus I square root of k squared plus m squared. So there was a pole here. Let me draw it with a different color. There was a pole here. And a pole here. Okay? And when you deform the contour of integration like that, of course, what you get as a contour of integration, you have to take care of what's happening near the pole. And what you get is that you get a contour of integration like that. Okay? This goes like that. Or in other words, in the omega complex plane, I get a contour integration like that. My poles here. Okay. And we can rewrite this prescription this contour integration prescription simply by writing a plus I epsilon plus and taking the limit epsilon. This goes to 0 plus. So you recover the Feynman propagator for the free field with the correct prescription of integration that respects causality when we are computing time-ordered products of operators. So we recover from Euclidean QFT, we recover real-time QFT with the correct causality constraint. Okay. So that's a good point. We are not doing something completely stupid and completely mathematically abstract. Okay. Yes? No. No question? Okay. So this is in fact the first calculation that we did with using this formalism, but it's a convincing, it's not a great discovery, but it's a convincing calculation. We recover the results of canonical quantization. Okay. So now let me go back to the propagator and discuss another point, which is quite important. It is, what are the short distance and large distance properties of this two-point function? And by the way, since we have shown that we recover the Feynman propagator for the free field, I'm going to call this two-point function the propagator. Although this is not the propagator we discussed the two first day, which are matrix elements of the evolution operator of the quantum theory. So same word for two different objects for historical reason. Okay, but not the evolution operator. Okay. So let's go back to, it's discussing the short distance properties of the object are easier in Euclidean space. So let us first discuss in Euclidean space, what are the properties of this G naught of X? Okay, the Fourier transform of this object. Well, first, in fact, I gave you the standard representation in Fourier space, but it can be computed exactly, and I have somewhere the expression, because if you make the calculation, it's somewhere in the notes. You can show that this is a special function. It's 1 over 2 pi, the modulus of the vector x divided by m to the power 2 minus d over 2 times a Bessel function of second kind, I think, of the ratio of the products of the modulus of x with the mass. Okay, so this is a Bessel function. K-nu, the second time. You can find them in books or on your computer. What's the shame of it? Okay. And so, either from this explicit expression, when you look in your mathematical on-book functions, or through the analysis of this object, we can deduce very easily what are the large distance and the short distance. So first, large distance. When x goes to infinity, it's easy to see that g naught of x behaves like is proportional to exponential of minus m times x. So this is an exponential decay. Okay. And this exponential decay means that, in fact, comes from the fact that there is a pole here at k squared plus m squared. So it comes from the pole. Fourier space. Okay. So this will be important in the following while discussing the physics, but at the moment, let's just remember that it has good properties at large distance if the mass is non-zero, because it's exponentially decaying. And of course, in real time, it will become say, oscillatory behavior. Okay, so that's in Euclidean space. Now, less trivial. What's the behavior at short distance? Namely, what's happening when x goes to zero? Oh, perhaps I didn't say it. It was obvious for me, but it's obvious that not only g of x is invariant by translation, but in Euclidean space, g of x depends, and that's clear here, it depends only on the modulus of x. It's invariant by rotation. That's the Euclidean version of the fact that this object should be invariant by Lorentz transformation in Minkowski space. Okay, so at short distance, let's start from this expression and see what's happening when x is very small. So if x is very small, this term doesn't oscillate for k quite large. So the contribution of large k is important in this integral. And if k is large, it means that k is much larger than m squared. So basically, you can neglect the mass term. Or if you prefer, the short distance behavior will be insensitive to the mass, so it will be the same for the massless theory and for the massive theory. And then this integral, if you forget about the mass, is just an integral of a k d divided by k squared. So it's a number, the dimension of k to the power d minus 2. And k has the dimension of minus distances. So in fact, this dimensional analysis shows that g0 of x should behave when x goes to 0 as x to the power 2 minus d. Minus the dimension of space. That's just by dimensional analysis. If you work a little bit more, you compute exactly these terms, and you can check that. I didn't write it here, but there is some coefficient, of course, here, some coefficient. Let us call it that depends on the dimension, and somewhere I have the expression. And you see, in fact, this result is valid if the dimension d is larger than 2. And in dimension 2, in space-time dimension 2, this is d dk over k squared, so there is a logarithmic divergence. So in fact, there is a log. Modulus of x, with a factor minus, here the coefficient is minus 1 over 2 pi. It's easy to compute. Okay. And in fact, we can compute everything this object in D equal 1, just a special case that you already computed yesterday. And in that case, this is finite because G of X behaves like one knows exactly the expression, so it's, we know that it's 1 over 2m exponential minus m times x, so it's finite. But here it's divergent. It's singular and divergent. Okay? Okay, so this is an expression that is valid for Euclidean spacetime. In Euclidean spacetime, you have just Euclidean time and space, and you have just a singularity at the origin. If you do the same analysis in Minkowski spacetime, of course, the structure of your propagator will be different because you have the light cone here. You have some causal singularity because the two-point function is real here. And here it is complex with an imaginary part that reflects the fact that you have a causality condition. But still, you have the same singularity that sits at coinciding space and time point. So you have a, what's called a short distance singularity. And the fact that it occurs at short distance means that it occurs at high momenta. And as well at high space momenta than energies, so it's high energy or momentum. And this is the first example of what's called an ultraviolet singularity. Ultraviolet because it occurs for high energies. So for, it occurs for the photons and it occurs for photons with large energies. And you will, in the course and everywhere, meet the acronym UV for ultraviolet. Okay, and that's a feature, new feature of QFT. That's also, that doesn't occur in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Because in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, that corresponds to just having one time, the two-point function is finite. Okay, that's a new feature of QFT, and it's an important feature, very important. And because it both will causes a lot of trouble, but contains a lot of physics and a lot of insights on the nature of what the quantum world is. Okay, so what's the meaning? Why are there, what does it mean to have such singularities? It means, so why? Well, it means that in fact that the two-point function G naught of zero, which is simply the vacuum expectation value of phi at two coinciding points, is infinite. So it means that in this path integral that was written just at the above, that we started from, phi has some divergent moments. Already the second order moment of phi at coincident points is not well defined. This means that this is a quite wild object. Phi is a wild object in the functional integral. And in fact, I had some pictures that I can show you, because I think those pictures are, well, won't say at that stage more than what I am stating here, but they give a nice picture of what it is. So let's check whether it's working. Maybe there is some guy. Oh, yes. So can you, thank you very much. I've not plugged the computer. Yes, now it's done. So let's see if something appears. Yes, good. Okay. This is don't be impressed by those pictures, because you can do them yourself on your computer very easily. Okay, so first here, you are seeing a typical configuration that occurs in the Euclidean path integral for a free particle. So that's D equal one. So this is a typical configuration contributing to the unitary evolution of a particle starting from zero at time t and zero and ending there at Euclidean time tau. So the classical trajectory should be a straight line where the particle don't move. This is position and this is time. But in fact, while we console, you discover that in fact the typical configuration corresponds simply to Brownian motions. So particle at each time she decides to go up, to go in this direction or in this direction with equal probabilities. But they are conditioned, of course, to end up at the end. So among all the possible Brownian walks as a function of time, we keep only those that end up here. And this is a typical Brownian motion, or what's called the Wiener process by mathematician. And you see that Brownian motion are already quite wild. In fact, you see from that they have fluctuation of the velocities that are very large. In fact, the velocity is infinite in the continuum time limit. But still, they are continuous function. That continuous function with no derivative, but that's objects that mathematicians discovered in the end of the 19th century, and now they are perfectly happy with that. Most functions are non-derivable. Okay. So they are non-derivable, but they are continuous. So now I'm going to show you the same thing for a quantum field. So I'm considering the free field. I'm going to call it Gaussian simply because we have seen that it's given by Gaussian functional integral. So here is a typical configuration that contributes to the functional integral for the free field in two dimensions. I'm in Euclidean space, so this is space and this is time, but this is Euclidean time. And of course, I have discretized my space-time. So my space-time is finite with a periodic boundary condition. And in addition, it's discretized at short distance. So here it's a short lattice. It's lattice 64 by 64. Okay? And a typical configuration you see as some wiggles. Now, the interesting thing is to see what's happening when we decrease the short distance cutoff. So the size of my lattice stays the same, but I am having a finer and finer mesh. And I'm trying to see what's the typical shape of the field configurations that are important in the path integral or the functional integral. Okay, so let's double the size of the lattice. And you see that the lattice becomes more, the field configuration becomes more spiky. Increase once again, it's become more spiky. Increase it once again, it becomes quite spiky. And in fact, the amplitude of the spikes grows logarithmically with the size of the lattice. And this reflects the logarithmic singularity we had. Okay. So, and I don't know if I have a picture. No. Okay, so that's the last one I did, but you can play, go further. And basically, in fact, you see that the configuration of the field phi that contributes in the functional integral are very, very, very singular. And if you work out their property, and that's easy to do, you discover that not only they are non-differentiable function, but they are not continuous function, and they are, in fact, they are not function at all. They are what's called distribution in the sense of Schwarz and the theory of distribution that you probably have seen. So this is a distribution. This is not a function. This is a distribution that is completely discontinuous and basically infinite at any point in space-time. But it's still a well-defined mathematical object, and there are things you cannot compute with them. For instance, you know that you cannot multiply distribution. And this reflect that, but you can still do math and physics with this solution. Okay. So now let's do the same thing in three dimensions. So this is a typical configuration. Of course, I've not represented a free field configuration in three dimensions, but I took a two-dimensional section of three-dimensional free field represented built in a cube with periodic boundary conditions. Again, this is a small lattice, finer lattice, finer lattice, finer lattice. It's again very spiky, and if you make measurements or compute, it's much more spiky in three dimensions than in two dimensions. Yes?
Are you assigning the same variance to every Fourier mode?
No, I assign to the Fourier modes of this field the correct variance that is given by the theory, that is 1 over k squared. That's why it's spiky.
But you're
okay? So it's not the Fourier transform of a function with random Fourier modes that are of the same amplitude. And that's why it's spiky. Okay. And that's okay. So that's something. Did I add something? I see. No. Well, that's all what I have to show you. I thought I had something else, but okay. And well, you can play with that in four dimensions. I think I had a picture, but it's somewhere else. But basically, the reason why there are the singularities, the travel singularities that I discussed before, is that because in the, well, one of the reasons to see that is that in the functional integral, the configuration that dominates are very, very singular and very well ill-defined at short distance. So that's a functional integral way to view this short distance singularity. But of course, we can also view them as properties of operators and the fact that the operators commute or do not commute in a special way in the quantum theory, which is different in the quantum theory than in ordinary non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Okay? Okay, so thank you. Can you switch off? Thank you very much. Okay, so I still have 15 minutes. That's cool. Oh, so now I wanted to say two or three more things. I discussed simply the two-point function. What about higher point functions? So let us say n points. We are interested in computing is a free theory, the expectation value of products of operator for n fields at n different points. So again, I will be just in the Euclidean for simplicity, but what I'm going to discuss is the same. Okay. So how do we compute this? Well, first you can see that, of course, that n has to be even. Otherwise, by parity, it's important. So n equal to m. How do we compute this? Well, using the functional integral formalism, that's very easy. Because since it's a Gaussian integral, this correlation function can be expressed in terms of cumulants. And the only non-trivial cumulants of a Gaussian distribution is a two-point distribution. So we have a theory of Gaussian distribution. And basically, this will be given by just a theorem of integrals of Gaussian distribution as a sum over all possible pairings of the point x1 up to x2m into pairs of phi of x, phi of x. So let us say that I construct the pairing phi of x up to phi of x, where I consider here, of course, I have here m equal n over 2 different pairs. So I consider a partition of my sets of points into sets of pairs. Okay. And this is called just a two-point cumulant. And this is a n-point correlation. Okay? And well, there are many ways to prove these results. But it's just a theorem on Gaussian distribution. So this is valid. This is very general. This is independent on the form of the distribution we consider. It's simply because we are considering an integral over some random variable of exponential of something minus of the form minus 1 half phi, some operators phi. This means, of course, here, phi dot phi means integral dx dy phi of x d of x and y phi of y, and this d for us d of x of y is equal to 1 over h bar uh, minus delta with respect to y plus m squared of delta of x minus y squared, which is a kernel what's going on. You see? Okay. So this is a property just of Gaussian distribution. And of course, this is just big theorem that you have derived in QFT1, but using the definition of this in terms of creation of annihilation operators and using the commutation relation between creation and annihilation operator to reordinate the creation, the annihilation, and end up with the same result. So, the Vick theorem in canonical quantization comes out from the commutation relation of the operators, and in the functional integral or path integral formalism, it comes from the fact that we are considering Gaussian integrals. Okay? So that's two different derivations, two different formalisms of the same result. And for instance, if we consider the four-point function, well, the best way to use this Vick theorem is to start to use what is called the Feynman, the famous Feynman diagrams. Namely, I am going to represent the propagator between 2.51 in phi 2 as a line between the point 1 and the point 2 in space. And this representation is the same irrespective of that we are working in Euclidean setting or real time, irrespective of the dimension of space-time. So it's a very convenient notation. Then the four-point function, which is phi of x1, phi of x2, phi of x3, phi of x4, I'm going to represent it by just this diagram. So I have a point 1. Well, let me just write 1, 2, 3, and 4 to represent the 4 point. Well, this will represent this object. And this object, for the free theory, is just given by the sum of all possible pairings between 4 points, and you can pair this point with this point, and this one with this one, or this one with this one, this one with this one, or this one with this one, and this one with this one. So you get a sum of a 4 pairings, this one, 1, 2, 3, 4, this one, 1, 3, 2, 4, and this one, 1, 4, 2, 3. Okay. For n equal 6, you get more terms. In fact, you get, I think, 15 terms. That I won't draw. They are in the notes. And this will be this representation of this correlation function or vacuum expectation value of products of phi field in terms of Feynman diagram. You already use them in QFT1 when computing diffusion amplitudes. I think you already, I presume, met them in the statistical mechanical course, where you did a similar perturbative expansion, but for statistical mechanics. And you possibly, or you are going to use them also in the condensed matter induction course, where similar perturbative expansion will involve Feynman diagrams, but with different kind of propagators. Okay? So I have still 5 minutes. So what should I do? Well, we are going to discuss in more detail the Feynman diagrams tomorrow, where we start to do the real difficult things, which is the interacting theory. So I think I will stop there at the moment. Perhaps I can discuss one slight subtle point, which is, I don't need that anymore. Okay, so 2 points. First, let us go back to my functional integral. In discretized Euclidean space. Remember, we started, but we got rid of the discretization by a space-time that was Euclidean, a d-dimensional network. At each point, we had a variable phi I, that was the value of the field phi at a point xi, with xi equal I times epsilon. Well, epsilon is the mesh of the lattice. And we had a partition function that was basically z, the analog products of a d phi I of exponential of minus SE of phi. Let me just set h bar to 1 to simplify. And this was a discretized version. So what was this discretized version? SE of phi, we have seen, was written as a sum over each side. There was an epsilon d. And there was a kinetic term that was involving the difference between the 2 points. And then a potential term that was involving the phi squared. So we can rewrite this Euclidean action just in terms of this discrete variable attached to discrete points. And if I am not mistaken, perhaps I made it. We can rewrite this simply. So let me first. The first kinetic term is the sum over all the sides, and then the sum of the derivatives in each direction. So you can rewrite this as a sum over all the links ij of the lattice. Here is a link. Here is another link, etc. And if I am not mistaken, you get a 1/2 epsilon d minus 2. And the derivative becomes phi i minus phi g squared. This is the derivative in the ig, the derivative at point I in the g direction squared. And then you get a sum over the sides of the lattice I. And the corresponding m phi squared term would become 1/2 m squared epsilon d phi of I squared. Okay, I'm just rewritten in terms of variable on the lattice my functional integral. Well, and let's keep the h bar. Okay. What is this? You can view this simply as this as a. We can view a field configuration phi I as a configuration of a set of oscillators on a lattice. So you have your lattice, and then each point of the phi, you have some spring. Okay? And this term represents the local frequency of the oscillators. Basically, this will be 1/2 of omega I squared. And this term represents the fact that those oscillators are coupled. So you have a set of oscillators that are coupled linearly. Linearly because the force between two oscillators is proportional to the difference between the position of the oscillators. So this is local oscillators. And this is means simply that we have a linear coupling on links between the neighboring oscillators. And this Z can be written simply as a sum over the configuration of my oscillators of exponential of minus beta times H, where I said that this is the energy of a configuration. And H bar is beta minus 1, namely it's KBT, so it's the temperature. See? So this is just a way to re-express the same object. This discretized functional integral for my quantum system in Euclidean style, I may as well consider it is as a partition function for a lattice of classical, those are classical oscillators, no quantum anymore, classical oscillators. Coupled between neighbors at finite temperature. Okay? And of course, this is just a reformulation of the problem. The math are exactly the same. Simply, I view this problem as a problem of equilibrium statistical mechanics. And the important, oh, I have to stop there. The important point is, in fact, is that QFT in 1 plus d minus 1 dimension is related to a classical statistical mechanics in d dimension. That's the first important fact. And the second important fact is that in this quantum system, Planck constant H bar corresponds in this system to the temperature. And for, in fact, an important reason, in a quantum system, you have quantum fluctuations. In a classical statistical system, you have thermal fluctuation. Well, this fluctuation in this formulation are described by the same mathematical apparatus, namely the functional integral. Of course, the nature of quantum fluctuation physically comes from very different origin than the thermal fluctuation. But for some problem at equilibrium, the mass are the same. You can use method of quantum mechanics to study statistical mechanical problem, and you can use method of statistical mechanics to study quantum problems. Okay, I end there. Thank you.